Hey everyone, and welcome to the show. You know how sometimes, like when you're reading a history book, you just kind of get lost in all the dates and the names and the big events, but then you realize, like, whoa, there were actual people like you and me living through all of that chaos.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's one thing to read about, say, a revolution or a war or, some huge societal upheaval, but it's a whole other thing to imagine what it must have been like to actually experience it firsthand, to have your whole world turned upside down.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we're diving into today, a story where, like, the fate of a whole nation is colliding with the lives of everyday people, and it's all seen through the eyes of one unforgettable woman.
And the really cool thing is we're not just talking about any random period in history. We're talking about like a truly pivotal moment, and we're going to see how those massive shifts played out in the most intimate corners of people's lives.
Yeah, and we're going deep into the realm of historical fiction for this one, folks. So strap in, because we're taking a deep dive into The Immortal Woman by Xu Chang. By the way, you can find a link to the book down in the description if you want to grab a copy and follow along. Now, just a quick heads up, if you're the kind of person who loves stories that really dig into what it means to be human, stories about resilience and identity and love and betrayal, well, you're in the right place.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this book, it's not just about history. It's about the enduring power of the human spirit. It's about how people find ways to survive and even thrive in the face of unimaginable challenges.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And hey, if you're enjoying this kind of deep dive, you know what to do. Hit that like button and subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes. So without further ado, let's get into it. This book, The Immortal Woman, it spans decades of Chinese history, but it's all told through the eyes of this one woman, LeMay. And it's through her experiences that we get this like incredibly intimate look at the Cultural Revolution and its aftermath.
You know what's really fascinating about this book is that it doesn't shy away from the complexity of that period. We see the brutality and the violence, but we also see moments of incredible courage and resilience and even love.
Right from the start, we're plunged into the heart of the Cultural Revolution, and the atmosphere is electric. It's almost surreal in a way. You have this teacher, Mrs. May, and she's being publicly shamed for the crime of teaching classical poetry. Can you believe that poetry by like legendary figures like Li Bai? It's like the regime is turning against its own cultural heritage.
Yeah, it's a really powerful example of how totalitarian regimes can distort and manipulate culture to serve their own ends. Even something as seemingly harmless as classical poetry can become a threat in their eyes.
And then there's this character, Pigsace. I mean, the name itself just screams intimidation, right? He's leading this Red Guard mob,
Yeah.
and they're all demanding that Mrs. Hayes may be imprisoned for, daring to teach poetry. It's just chilling to imagine.
It really highlights the climate of fear and paranoia that gripped the country during that time. Anyone could become a target for the slightest perceived transgression.
And what struck me was this young Red Guard Feng. He's the one who actually puts the bourgeois revisionist element placard on Mrs. May. But you can see that he's hesitant. Like there's this flicker of doubt in his eyes. You get the sense that he's not fully on board with what he's doing, but he's too afraid to speak out.
That's such a crucial detail because it reminds us that not everyone involved in the Cultural Revolution was a true believer. Many people were swept up in the movement out of fear or desire to conform, or maybe even just a lack of other options.
And then there's that scene outside the Shanghai Music Conservatory. It's just brutal. And an elderly woman, she's wearing this dunce cap that they call a witch's hat, and she's being physically abused by this young Red Guard for supposedly poisoning the youth with bourgeois music. And the most disturbing part, a policeman is just standing there watching, doing nothing.
It's a really disturbing image, and it speaks volumes about the breakdown of law and order during that time. The authorities were either complicit in the violence or simply powerless to stop it.
And this is the world that our main character, LeMay, is navigating.
Ugh.
She's initially just an observer trying to make sense of the chaos swirling around her, but soon enough, she gets pulled into the thick of it, and it starts with her friendship with this girl named Wei.
Wei's story is particularly tragic because her parents, they were these idealistic doctors who had actually returned to China from America to serve their country, but their Western education and their ties to the outside world end up making them targets of suspicion and persecution.
It's heartbreaking, The ransacking of their home, the arrest of her parents. It's a stark reminder of how easily the political can invade the personal and tear lives apart.
And yet, despite all of that, Wei shows this incredible resilience. She cuts her hair short as a kind of act of rebellion, and she even makes these dark jokes about the book burning, saying, "Burning books all night long, they only scratch the surface. It's my parents' revenge."
It's like she's using humor as a defense mechanism, a way to cope with the immense pain and injustice she's experiencing.
Exactly. And it's also a subtle form of resistance. You know, she's refusing to let the regime break her spirit.
But the pressure to conform is relentless. Even Wei's parents are forced to write her this letter, disowning her. It's a heartbreaking example of how families were torn apart during that time. People were forced to choose between loyalty to their loved ones and loyalty to the party.
And of course, that choice was never really a choice at all. You know, the consequences of defying the party were too terrible to contemplate.
LeMay herself isn't immune to the pressure either. Feng, the Red Guard we met earlier, he warns her to stay away from Wei, telling her that Chairman Mao said you need to be able to distinguish between your friends and your enemies. It's a chilling reminder of how deeply the political ideology had seeped into every aspect of life, even personal relationships.
It created this atmosphere of suspicion and distrust where people were constantly looking over their shoulders, wondering who they could trust.
And as the Cultural Revolution intensifies, the violence escalates. There are these clashes between rival Red Guard factions, and the radio keeps broadcasting these vague pronouncements about supporting rebels. But it's never clear who the rebels are or what they're supposed to be rebelling against.
It was a time of incredible uncertainty and instability. You know, the rules were constantly changing and people were just trying to survive.
And then there's the death of Teacher Lai, the math teacher. He's imprisoned in the school cowshed and ends up taking his own life using a sharpened toothbrush. It's a truly horrific scene, and Lamai's reaction is so chilling. She just recites this quote from Mao, "Communism is not love. Communism is a hammer we use to crush the enemy."
It's a really powerful moment because it shows how the ideology had dehumanized her to the point where she could no longer even feel empathy for someone who had been so brutally killed.
Yeah.
And just as suddenly as it began, the Red Guard movement starts to wane. A new directive comes down from the top. Urban youths are to be sent to the countryside to learn from the peasants. It's another massive disruption, another way for the regime to exert control over people's lives.
It was a way to break up the Red Guard factions and to disperse the urban youth who were seen as a potential source of unrest.
Lamai's father is sent to a cadre school, a kind of re-education camp for intellectuals and officials, and Lamai starts having these recurring nightmares about his suffering. She dreams about his leg shackles, his bloodied shirt, the smell of her mother's medicinal concoctions. It's a constant reminder of his absence and the pain he's enduring.
It's a really visceral way of conveying the trauma that Lamai and her family are experiencing. You know, the nightmares are a manifestation of her fear and her powerlessness.
And then her father is accused of voodoo worship, a completely absurd charge, clearly fabricated just to make him a target. And of course, he's found guilty, and he eventually dies while he's still imprisoned. The news is delivered in this cold, impersonal letter from the Revolutionary Committee. It's just another example of the regime's complete disregard for human life.
It shows how easily people could be accused, condemned, and disposed of during that time. You know, there was no due process, no justice.
And throughout all of this, there's this constant pressure to demonstrate revolutionary purity. People adopt this kind of robotic way of speaking. They call it mannequin talk, and they quote the Little Red Book at every opportunity. It's like they're trying to erase their individuality and become these perfect little communist automatons.
It's a form of self-censorship and self-preservation. You know, people learn that it was dangerous to express any kind of individuality or dissent.
And then we meet this new Red Guard leader, Changshen. He's portrayed as being particularly ruthless and ambitious, and Lamai sees right through him. She knows that he's just another opportunist using the revolution to advance his own career.
He represents the corrupting influence of power. You know, even within a movement that claims to be about equality and justice, there are always those who will exploit it for their own gain.
And Changshen sets his sights on LeMay. He offers to make her a leader in the Red Guards, but she's deeply suspicious of his motives, and she tries to decline his offer, using her father's unclean record as an excuse. It's a desperate attempt to protect herself, but it also shows how trapped she is in this system.
It's a catch-22 situation. You know, if she refuses his offer, she risks being seen as disloyal to the revolution. But if she accepts it, she's essentially selling her soul to the devil.
Her mother Ma gives her some blunt advice. She tells her, save yourself by joining the Red Guards. It's heartbreaking to see a mother having to give her daughter such advice, but Ma knows that it's the only way to ensure LeMay's survival.
It shows the impossible choices that people were forced to make during that time. You know, sometimes the only way to survive was to compromise your own morals.
But even in the midst of all this darkness, there are still glimmers of hope. Wei continues to defy the regime in her own small ways. She maintains her friendship with Lamai, and they even secretly exchange banned literature like Tolstoy's The Kreutzer Sonata. It's a reminder that even in the most oppressive environments, the human spirit can still find ways to resist.
It's a testament to the enduring power of art and literature to transcend boundaries and to connect people on a deeper level.
But the danger is always present. Changshin's true colors are eventually revealed when he tries to sexually assault Lamai. It's a horrifying moment, and it shows how easily power can be abused, even within a movement that claims to be about liberation.
It's a reminder that patriarchy and misogyny can exist even within revolutionary movements.
LeMay is eventually forced to take a job writing propaganda for the Revolutionary Committee. It's a deeply compromising position, and she finds herself constantly having to contradict her own beliefs and rewrite her own articles based on the ever-shifting political winds. It leads to a widespread sense of cynicism among the public, as people come to realize that they can't trust anything they read or hear.
It creates this climate of disillusionment and distrust where people feel like they've lost their voice and their agency.
And then finally, after years of turmoil and upheaval, Chairman Mao dies. It's a moment of huge historical significance. But even the public mourning is turned into this strange kind of performance with people competing to show how much they're grieving. It's like even in death, Mao's cult of personality continues to hold sway.
It shows how deeply ingrained the habits of conformity and obedience had become. You know, even in grief, people felt the need to perform for the state.
The aftermath of Mao's death is a period of great uncertainty and instability. There's a power struggle within the party, and eventually Deng Xiaoping emerges as the new leader. He initiates a series of reforms that begin to open up China to the outside world and to loosen the grip of the Communist Party.
It's a time of cautious optimism, but there's still a lot of fear and uncertainty. You know, people are wondering if these reforms will last or if the country will slide back into repression.
Wei decides to seize the opportunity and she emigrates to America, leaving Lamai behind. It's a bittersweet moment for Lamai. She's happy for her friend, but she also feels a sense of loss and perhaps even a bit of envy.
It highlights the complex emotions that many Chinese people felt during that time. You know, they were excited about the new possibilities that were opening up, but they were also aware of the risks and the sacrifices involved.
Fen continues to pine after Lamai, watching her from a distance and harboring this distorted view of their past relationship. He's clearly still obsessed with her, but he also seems to resent her for rejecting him. It's a sad and unsettling dynamic.
It shows how unresolved emotions and personal traumas can linger long after the events that caused them.
Feng eventually returns to his village to care for his dying mother, even though he holds the coveted Shanghai Huku, which allows him to live and work in the city. It's a sign that he's starting to reevaluate his priorities and to recognize the importance of family ties.
It's a reminder that even in the most individualistic societies, family still matters.
But before he leaves, Shanghai Feng has this final confrontation with LeMay. It's a violent and disturbing encounter fueled by his unrequited love and his resentment. It's a tragic reminder of the damage that can be done by unresolved emotional baggage.
It shows how the personal and the political can become dangerously intertwined.
LeMay eventually moves to America herself, and she experiences all the challenges of adapting to a new culture. She struggles to connect with people, she feels like an outsider, and she even finds herself seeking solace in the most unlikely of places in the TV show Gilmore Girls.
It's a reminder that even the most mundane things can offer comfort and connection in times of stress and upheaval.
She has a relationship with a man named Sasha, and they have a daughter together named Pearl. But the relationship eventually falls apart, leaving Lamai to raise her daughter as a single mother. It's a difficult and isolating experience, but she finds strength and support from her mother and from a new friend, Dali, another Chinese immigrant who has feelings for her that she doesn't reciprocate.
It shows the importance of community and support networks, especially for immigrants who are navigating a new and often challenging environment.
Lamai eventually suffers a mental breakdown and has to be hospitalized. It's a stark reminder of the toll that trauma and displacement can take on a person's mental health.
It highlights the importance of seeking help when you're struggling and of recognizing that mental health is just as important as physical health.
Through therapy and through her reading of post-colonial literature, Lamai begins to unpack her complex feelings about her Chinese identity. She starts to understand how her experiences have been shaped by history and by the legacy of colonialism.
It's a process of self-discovery and of coming to terms with the multiple layers of your own identity.
She starts seeking out Chinese books in Toronto, and she eventually finds a connection with this eccentric bookseller. It's like she's trying to reclaim a part of herself that she thought she'd lost.
It shows the power of books and of culture to bridge divides and to create a sense of belonging.
Lamai gets involved in a protest about Hong Kong, and she finds herself torn between her loyalty to her homeland and her new life in Canada. It's a conflict that many immigrants experience as they try to reconcile their past with their present.
It highlights the challenges of navigating multiple identities and loyalties in a globalized world.
After many years in Canada, Lamai decides to return to China with Pearl. She's drawn back to her roots, and she wants her daughter to experience her cultural heritage firsthand.
It's a homecoming of sorts, a chance for Lamai to reconnect with the place where she came from and to make peace with her past.
She has this unexpected reunion with Feng, who has changed a lot since their last encounter. He's more mature, more humble, and he seems genuinely remorseful for his past behavior. It's a sign that healing and forgiveness are possible, even after the most painful experiences.
It's a hopeful note in a story that's often quite dark and tragic.
Lamai decides to stay in China, and she establishes a school in her ancestral village dedicated to providing education for migrant children. It's a beautiful act of service, and it symbolizes her commitment to her community and to the future of China.
It's a way for her to give back and to make a positive impact on the world.
And finally, she visits the Temple of the Immortal Woman. It's a moment of quiet contemplation and spiritual renewal. It's like she's finally come full circle and found a sense of peace and acceptance.
It's a powerful ending to a truly remarkable story.
Wow. So there you have it, folks, our deep dive into The Immortal Woman. What an incredible journey we've been on.
Absolutely. It's a story that stays with you long after you've finished reading it.
Now, we want to hear from you. What resonated with you the most about Lamai's story? What were your favorite moments? What are your thoughts on the themes of resilience, identity, and belonging that the book explores?
Yeah, jump into the comment section below and share your thoughts with us. And if you're new here, be sure to hit that like button and subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes.
And here's a final thought for you to ponder. After experiencing such profound personal and societal trauma, can true healing and a sense of belonging ever be fully achieved? Or is the search for identity an ongoing lifelong journey of adaptation, reconciliation, and reinvention? Let us know what you think. And until next time, happy reading, everyone.
Take